Thank you for standing by. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you need assistance during the call, please press star then zero. You may now begin.
Good morning, everybody. This is Sean Brooks. I'd like to welcome you to the January 2013 CHARM presentation. Today's presentation will be given to us by David Seal of Jet Propulsion Laboratory. For those of you who don't know Dave, he is currently a group supervisor in the Mission Planning and Engineering section here at JPL. He is currently working on Cassini, but he's also branched off into other projects, Destiny, as far as I know, in addition to his group supervising aspect. He used to be the mission planning lead, and it is in that capacity that he'll be speaking to us today. He is a graduate of MIT, and Dave, remind me, I think you came here in when, the 90s?
Yeah, a long time ago. Thanks. That was fine. 1991 I started.
A lot of time to do some really good work here at JPL. I want to remind everyone that if you need to mute yourself, you can just hit star 6. And with that, I will let Dave begin with his presentation, Here There Be Dragons, Navigating Saturn's Treacherous Dust Hazards. So, Dave, take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Just a quick question. Should I go for 45 minutes and leave time for questions, or go for an hour and there'll still be time for questions at the end?
I say you take as much time as you need to take. We have the line for 2 hours. We're only expecting to go about an hour or so, but if you need to take the hour and people have questions, I think that won't be a problem.
Okay, great. Well, I haven't timed it, so I have no idea how long it'll take, but something around there will probably be the target. Anyway, thanks again, Sean, for the kind introduction. It's a real pleasure for me to be speaking to you today. This is a really challenging and interesting issue for Cassini, and I hope you find it interesting as well. It's definitely something that's occupied a lot of my time. One might even say nightmares on occasion, since about the mid-90s, a few years after I came here when I started working on this issue. And it's a really good choice of topics, I think. To try to expose you guys to and illuminate some of what happens in sort of the real world engineering of flight projects here at JPL, the kind of decision making that we have to go through, and hopefully it'll expose you to some of
PowerPoint
the
upset. It was KK.
Sorry,
I was talking to a friend here.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I'm not the only person who is in that telecom from you, for I'm calling from Holland, you see.
Oh, great. It's wonderful to have you. I guess we have spanned almost the entire globe. I know we've got the U.S. and Guam and Europe, so excellent. Anyway, so I hope you enjoy talking.
May I say an idea I have about the whole thing? Is it more or less the same where we are confronted with now, which we had in the very beginning, when the Cassini-Huygens drove through the, what is it, the G and H ring. Between it, then you got that tickle, as pebbles on the roof of a tin roof.
Yeah, exactly.
You understand what I mean?
I will definitely talk about that. So, let me give me a chance to get there first. Thanks. I'd like to start off with hopefully everyone's had a chance to get the charts. I'm sorry I neglected to put page numbers on them, but hopefully you can see what page you're on from your Acrobat reader. And I'll try to give the titles as we go. But I'd like to start off with a question and maybe a puzzle. So page 2 poses the simple question of why do you wear your seatbelt when you're in your car? And there's a number of pretty obvious answers that pretty much spring to mind right away, I'm sure. But I'm hoping that you'll take a few seconds to actually really think about it in a little bit more detail as to why. What goes to your head, you know, when you think about wearing it? You know, there are some other questions that might be related. Is why don't we drive tanks if we're really worried about car safety? And on the other hand, why don't why do we have seatbelts at all? Why do we have any sort of safety measures in vehicles at all? Why don't we just drive cars where we're completely exposed and there's nothing but four wheels and an engine? And some of the thoughts that come to mind right away is, well, you know, the seatbelt could save your life. Someday, my parents taught me to wear my seatbelt, and I'm continuing to follow their advice. Certainly in the U.S., it's the law to wear your seatbelt, I believe, in all states. But really, the main concept that I'm sure we're all thinking of is what happens if we get into a car accident. So, and that's a risk, right? So we're trying to reduce the consequences of a risk. And if we go to page 3, that's really what we're talking about here is a discipline of engineering that we spend some time at on every project here at JPL that we call risk management. And basically, when you are concerned with something bad that might happen, you know, there's a particular thought process that you tend to go through. First, you try to figure out what is the likelihood of that happening. And for a car accident, you know, most of us are fortunate enough that we don't get into a really bad accident at any point in our lives. But unfortunately, probably most of us do know someone that does. But essentially, you know, when you get in your car every day or whenever you do, the likelihood of getting into an accident is really quite low. It almost never happens. And if you just thought about it that way, you might conclude, well, why wear your seatbelt at all? I mean, it's hardly ever going to happen, so why bother? Well, the next level of thought is you try to think about what the consequence or the impact of that is. And it's certainly for getting into a car accident, the impact, possible negative consequence could be very high. You know, you could lose your life. So what risk management does in part is, you know, we tend to multiply those two things together. And if we wind up with a number that is medium or higher, it tends to imply that we should consider doing something about it. In the case of a car accident, you know, the odds are low that it'll happen, but the negative consequence is very high. So you sort of multiply those two together and you get kind of a medium number. So it makes sense that we should do something. So the kind of things that we do, which we tend to call mitigations, are, you know, cars come with seatbelts these days. We tend to wear them if we want to mitigate the risk. A lot of cars have airbags. You know, most of us learn how to drive defensively. Other things like trying not to text while you drive, that kind of thing. We tend to drive more carefully when there's bad weather, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a number of different ways that we can sort of manage the risk of getting into an accident. Other sort of low probability events or low likelihood events that are kind of useful thought experiments for risk management are, you know, what happens if you lose your keys to your car or your house? Well, you keep spares. You maybe hide a key to your house somewhere where no one will find it in case you get locked out. But you don't, like, handcuff your keys to your wrist. You know, you don't go to more extreme measures because the impact of losing your keys is not that high. It's not like a car accident where you could be injured or killed, right? Things like, you know, if your car or your house is broken into, some people, you know, invest in security systems. They choose to be more worried about, you know, that risk, maybe because they have more valuables than people that don't, or maybe they're just more worried about it because they think the risk is higher for some reason. There are some kind of silly and extreme cases like being struck by a meteorite or nuclear war. These are really low probability events. And certainly, fortunately, since at least the mid-80s, the nuclear war case is a pretty low likelihood, so most of us don't really take any mitigation steps to avoid those. I grew up in, you know, the 70s and 80s. This is certainly around the time, you know, this is the continuation of the Cold War that began in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, there were certainly times when everyone was worried about the problem of nuclear war. And some of us may even remember being in places where we had to practice, you know, in case, you know, we had to learn what to do. And some people even had bomb shelters. So the kind of thought of how to, you know, assess these risks and what their likelihood certainly changes with time. Certainly hardly anyone walks around worrying about being struck by a meteorite, and certainly no one takes any steps to mitigate it. So depending on the likelihood and the impact or the probability and the consequence, depending on what kind of terms you're most comfortable with, you know, there are different steps that might be taken. And this is certainly an important sort of concept to think about when we're talking about when we're worried about avoiding impacts from dust in the Saturn system, because we have to know what the likelihood is of hitting something, and we have to know what the consequences if we hit it. You know, certainly bigger things will cause more damage than little things, but we have to really measure that and figure out whether the product of the likelihood and the consequence is high enough for us to do something. And that's basically what I've been tasked to do, what I was tasked to do starting in the mid-90s and had to worry about. Which brings us to page 4, which is, of course, fine art. And our friend from the Netherlands may recognize this picture. Please don't give it away. This is this is my favorite painting. It seems like a segue, but I promise there's a connection. And it's not a terribly well-known painting, so you shouldn't feel bad if you don't recognize it at all. This painting is interesting to me for a number of reasons, but one reason is that there's a little something going on in this painting that you might have to hunt for to find. And I'll give you a few seconds maybe to look around and find it. At first glance, it's, you know, a nice pastoral scene. There's a farmer that's, you know, tilling his fields. There's a shepherd gazing up at the sky with his flock of sheep. You know, it's a nice sort of nautical scene. This kind of reminds me of where I grew up on the east coast of the U.S. With a naval vessel and a little town off in the distance. But if you're looking around the picture, you might notice something curious happening in the lower right-hand corner. There's kind of a splash and a few things flying in the air there, and looks like legs sticking out of the water there. And that's the theme of the painting, although it's interesting to me that it's sort of you sort of have to hunt to find it. Anyway, this painting is called Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. It's a Flemish painting from the mid 16th century. It was originally attributed to Peter Bruegel, who's a reasonably well-known Flemish painter. If you know the Flemish painters of this period, but in the mid 90s, I think there was some analysis done, and that attribution is regarded as kind of doubtful. I think this is a really good copy done by a member of a colleague of Peter Bruegel's in the same school. Anyway, the story of Daedalus and Icarus is probably familiar to many of you. It's a really great myth for engineers, and it's appropriate to this problem. Most of us in the aerospace engineering field or the planetary science field or the astronomy field have at least a passing familiarity with Greek and Roman myth, since many of the bodies of the solar system are named after figures from Greek and Roman myth. Daedalus and Icarus was a Greek myth referenced in Ovid and many other works of ancient Greek literature. Daedalus and Icarus were imprisoned on Crete by King Minos. Daedalus created the labyrinth to house the Minotaur, and was subsequently imprisoned in the labyrinth, and Daedalus, the father of Icarus, made this great feat of engineering, which is why I think it's cool, of building wings for him and his son so that they could escape the island of Crete. Icarus, in his sort of youthful foolishness or hubris, flew too close to the sun, other than being warned by this, you know, contrary to being warned not to by his father. The wax that was made, that the wings were made of in part, melted, and he subsequently fell into the sea before he could reach safety. So this is a great myth because it's a story about a feat of engineering. It's a metaphor, I think, for escaping, you know, they escape Crete is metaphor for escaping the bonds of ignorance through engineering, which is a very appealing kind of idea for engineers. Certainly those of us here at JPL that use engineering to explore the solar system and allow us to free ourselves from our ignorance of the wonderful things that are happening out there. And I just in finishing on this chart, you know, I kind of like the fact that the fall of Icarus goes completely unnoticed by the rest of the figures in the landscape, which is kind of humbling, even with this great mythical story and this great feat of engineering. The complete failure of it, you know, life goes on. I that tickles me. So, anyway, to end, you know, this is kind of a very, also to me, a very appealing story for worrying about dust hazards, because, you know, through foolishness or ignorance, you know, Cassini, you know, might have faced more hazards and been damaged. And it's certainly we have to be humble and not have too much youthful pride or hubris and not fly too close to the sun, metaphorically speaking. So let's get back to the subject at hand, which is the planetary rings. In general, I'm on page 5 now. Many of you probably know that all of the outer planets have ring systems. All of the missions until Cassini really didn't have to do too much in terms of worrying about hazards from the ring systems. Cassini really was the first mission that had to grapple with this in some detail. The other missions either didn't know that the hazards existed because they didn't know the rings existed, or they chose to avoid them altogether because they had hardly any knowledge or it was easy for them to do so. Cassini was really a first mission that had to really grapple with this extensively, and that was certainly our job. And we've paved, you know, the previous missions, the information they gathered was very helpful to us in terms of figuring out what to do, and our strategies are certainly paving the way for missions in the future. Juno is on its way to Jupiter right now. New Horizons is on its way to Pluto. New Horizons in particular is really grappling with this and is having, you know, a bit of a tough time trying to figure out, trying to assist the hazards. They're grappling with a lot of the same problems that we had to. If you go to page 6, this is kind of some key images of the outer planet ring systems that some of you may be familiar with. The image on the top is an image, one of the most famous images that Cassini has taken, a mosaic that we took, I believe, back in 2006. The sun's behind the planet, so kind of like headlights on a dusty windshield of a car. Again, to go back to car metaphors, you know, this kind of geometry is really good at illuminating all the different dust that's in the Saturn system. And you can see that there is dust almost everywhere. The main rings, which are the brightest feature at the center, is what all of us are familiar with. But outside of those, you can see there's quite a bit of other stuff there and other stuff for us to worry about. You've also got images on the bottom. Jupiter, I believe this is Voyager 1. This may have been the discovery image, actually, of Jupiter's rings. You've got Uranus as well. This is actually a ground-based image taken by the Keck telescope in Hawaii. And the image on the lower right is the Neptunian rings, which were discovered by Voyager 2. So all the planetary systems have rings. Saturn's, of course, we all know, is the most prominent. It's the ring planet we're most familiar with. And page 7, which is also titled Outer Planet Ring Systems, is kind of a more technical chart. It kind of reprojects these different rings sort of all in sort of a similar coordinate system where, you know, on the vertical axis, you know, 1.0 is the sort of the cloud tops of each of the major planets. Zero would be the center of the planet, so that's kind of looking outward as you go up on this chart. And I've tried to highlight, all these charts show the rings, but I've also tried to highlight where the different missions have crossed the ring systems. Jupiter, you have Juno, and Juno, which hasn't gotten there yet, is planning to cross very close to Jupiter. Galileo, you can see, crossed far out beyond the main ring system. And they didn't have any crossings that were close to Jupiter after that. So Galileo really, in the mid-90s, didn't have to, really worry about ring hazards. At Saturn, Pioneer 11, which was there in 1979, they did not know the G ring, you can see there, existed. They certainly detected some hints of it, but I believe the discovery of the G ring was really attributed to Voyager 1, which was the first to actually image it. And Voyager 2, you know, you could see it cross through the region that we now know, or we now call the region of the G ring, but Voyager 2 was actually aiming to miss it entirely, so they didn't know the G-ring had sort of a broader extent like we do now. The CAS little bit that's the upper of the two, that is where we chose to cross when we got to Saturn. As one of our listeners pointed out earlier, we did indeed hear some sort of rain on the roof, rain on the tin roof. But that was believed, and I'll talk about that later, to be the safest location that we could go without seriously compromising the mission. And there's a lower one that's a CAS that I'll talk about later. And Uranus and Neptune, you could see, we didn't get close to the ring systems of Uranus, Voyager 2 at Neptune. was well beyond the known ring system. So again, Cassini really is the first mission that's had to grapple with this. So the next page, page 8, just is a summary of the historical encounters, which I've just mentioned, so we can more or less skip over that. So I thought, starting at page 9, title of Saturn's Rings, I thought it might be fun just to kind of remind ourselves of the great things about Saturn's rings. Certainly, there. If you've dialed into previous talks, you've heard more from scientists about these. There have been some recent talks to talk about the rings. This first image is an image that we took quite recently. It's another global mosaic taken with the sun behind the planet. I think this image was compiled with a few different wavelengths, different filter settings than the one we showed earlier that has been around longer and that you may be more familiar with. So that's probably the reason why the color balance looks a little bit different here. These images are really good for ring scientists to see features in the rings that you just can't see when the rings are illuminated in other ways. You know, it really takes specific geometries and specific illuminations to see certain features, and certainly to be able to detect the most faint rings. You need to have the sun almost behind the rings, but you need to be in geometries like this where the sun is actually obscured because you can't point the cameras directly at the sun or they'll be damaged. But when the sun is behind Saturn, as in this case in the previous image, those are good opportunities for us to study things. So that's why we take these images in part. They're also incredibly pretty, so they're good for the public too. On page 10, you see these are images of two gaps, what we thought were gaps in the rings. We thought a lot of areas in the rings were gaps, and it turns out, I think after we got to Saturn, we realized that there's plenty of stuff even in the areas where we thought were gaps. So as I'll talk about later, you can see that there was certainly a learning process involved in sort of managing our understanding of the rings. The gap on the left is called the Keeler Gap. That's a gap that's almost on the very outer edge of the main rings, and as you can see, there's actually a satellite in there that's sort of maintaining the gap. And even in other images, I think we see that there's certainly dust in the gap. It looks black in this picture, but it isn't in others. The one on the right is the Encke Gap. You can see all the different beautiful structure that's complex structure. Even in a really highly zoomed in image, it's almost like a fractal. You know, no matter how once you zoom in, you still see the same level of complexity. And you can see that there's certainly a band in the middle of the Encke Gap there. And in other images that are more sort of stretched or overexposed by processing, you know, there's certainly stuff all throughout this gap. The next image, the next two images actually show, this would be page 11 and 12, show some really interesting structure in the F ring, which is just beyond the main rings of Saturn. You know, this is the kind of complexity that I don't know that we could possibly have predicted. You know, that these features are caused by gravitational interactions with stuff that's in the rings as well as large satellites that are sort of nearby. I think the thought is some of the little dots that you see in at least the picture on page 11 are thought maybe to be bodies within the rings that kind of float in and out. It's kind of, you know, the ring is kind of like a fluid. You know, there's hardly any gravity, you know, in the rings if you're orbiting with them. You only feel the gravity really from moons that kind of pass in and out of the rings or float around with the other material, and that's what causes these complex and really beautiful structures. Page 12, you can actually see a satellite on the image on the right. That's a satellite, Prometheus. Sort of mucking about with a ring there. Its orbit is slightly eccentric, so it kind of floats in and out of the F ring at a certain times of the year. In this case, you can see that it's sort of carved past channels, and it's in the middle of carving a new one now. And this structure of these channels and these sort of notches in the brightest part of the ring is something that we've studied quite a bit and learned a lot about since we've been there. Page 13, this is one of my favorite images. This is near equinox, where the sun was nearly sort of in the ring plane, so it was casting, illuminating topography of the rings. The rings actually have topography, the main rings do, due to larger bodies within the rings, as well as satellites outside of the rings that have slight inclinations that aren't just stuck to the ring plane. And this is just sort of the sun casting long shadows of the bumpy parts of, in this case, sort of the middle of the main rings onto the rest of the ring system. Anyway, page 14, let's get back to Hazard. So again, this is the 2006 picture that shows that, you know, you could argue, and I think successfully, that there's really no part of the ring system that we're looking at here, no part of the Saturn system that we're looking at here that doesn't have dust in the ring plane. It's orbital mechanics dictates that we have to cross the ring plane twice every orbit. So, you know, pretty much twice every orbit, we have to sort of think about what we're doing, and we have to be careful about where we place those ring plane crossings to make sure that we don't take too much risk, like Icarus, and risk, in our case, loss of mission. Certainly, the main rings, we had no thoughts of flying through those, and we still have no plans to fly through those. Generally, the joke is if light has a tough time getting through, I think our spacecraft would too. And for the most case, light does have a tough time getting through. The rings look bright here because, you know, there some amount of light gets through. It's a pretty sort of in sort of conventional camera terms, it's a pretty overexposed image. And certainly the bright parts of the ring are the areas where light has less of a problem getting through, but it's still pretty opaque in general, and there's really hardly any chance that we would survive a passage through the main rings at any place, even in what we now call the Cassini division, which I think at one point was called the Cassini gap, which is actually bright in this image. It's sort of just beyond the dark central part of the main ring. So here's where we start having to think about what the rings actually look like on a small scale. And I've tried to have some pictures on page 15. Title is also Saturn's rings. There's a sort of a blue spheres chart on the right if you're trying to follow along. So one of the things we have to do is assess you know, what do these rings really look like on a small scale? And by rings, certainly the ring scientists think about the main rings, but we're not planning to fly through those. There's no way we'd survive, so we have to really worry about the rest of the ring system. But we have to ask the same question. So are these ring systems, is it all little stuff? Is it all big stuff? Is it a size distribution where there are some little things and some big things? These are key questions. And the answer that we figured out after, you know, talking to a lot of scientists, is that most of these ring systems have a distribution of sizes of stuff in them. It's kind of like dirt, soil, maybe sand on a beach is a decent analogy, although it's not the best one, where if you're walking along the beach, you know, most everything is these small, tiny little sand particles. Once in a while, you'll come across a pebble or, you know, a boulder. But in general, you know, these ring systems are mostly small stuff and fewer large things because, you know, when you knock, rocks together over a very long period of time, like, you know, what's happened to evolve into a beach or certainly in space, what's happened when you hit two things together and they hit, you know, they collide with other objects, and over time you get a ring that's composed of more small things than big things is generally the rule, just because that's just the physics of how stuff sort of disintegrates based on impacts and other phenomena. Now, in general, if you want to go to page 16, this is a really classic mission planning problem to grapple with, and it's a tough one. It's not like most of the problems that we study in college when we're studying engineering or science. We don't have all the answers. You know, it's not an easy problem where you have a formula to solve and you know exactly with complete certainty what all of the different quantities are, and you just have to, you know, churn through the formula and solve it. You know, we don't, before we got to Saturn, and even still today, you know, we didn't fully understand the ring environment. You know, Voyager and Pioneer were the discoverers of some of these rings. And, you know, we didn't have any of the images that I've shown you, except some of the ones at the very beginning. So we really didn't have a lot of knowledge about what was there. You know, Pioneer 11, Voyager 1 and 2 flew by Saturn just once. You know, they took, you know, as many images as they could. They studied as much as they could through other means, but they were only there for a rather short time. And we only had a very limited amount of data to work with. But that's the whole point, right? I mean, we built and designed Cassini to go to Saturn to study the environment, to learn about it. So, of course, that it makes sense that we don't understand it. That's why we're going there. However, you know, we need to be able to figure out what the hazards are from this environment. And in order to make intelligent decisions about those hazards, we need to know what the environment is. Go back to the first question. It's a circular problem, right? We don't understand it. That's why we're going. We need to understand it to make decisions. So, you know, you could drive yourself nuts trying to figure out what to do with this kind of situation because you have very incomplete data. There's a lot of uncertainties. The answers are tough. And, you know, there's a number of ways to respond to this kind of situation. You know, and if I may draw an analogy back to the seatbelt case, you know, say we didn't really know what the likelihood of getting into a car accident was. We didn't really know what a seatbelt or other protective measures would really do for us. You know, you could choose like one of two extremes. You could say, well, I'm terrified about getting into a car accident. I think it's almost certain to happen. I'm just never going to leave the house. I'm not even going to buy a car. I'm just going to stay at home all the time. Well, sure, that may keep you safe, but it certainly cramps your lifestyle, and you would never leave the house. You would never see your friends and family. You would never learn anything, although through the Internet we can learn just about everything these days. The other extreme is you say, well, I don't know the answers to these questions, so I'm just not going to worry about it. You're going to sort of just bury your head in the sand. You ignore the hazard completely like Icarus. It's too hard. You know, this problem isn't like the problems I had in college, so I'm just not even going to try to figure it out, and I'm just going to drive wherever I want and not even worry about the risk. Well, that's probably not a very good approach either. So obviously, the middle way is the way that we took, where you do the best you can with what you have, and you try to make the most intelligent decisions, and you try to be neither too conservative. In our case, being too conservative would mean we would never even go to Saturn in the first place. We would never learn anything about it. What's the point of having a mission? Or maybe slightly less conservative is we'd stay so far away from those rings that we've already seen that we would never get anywhere near Saturn or some of the most interesting features of it, and we would, you know, spend a lot of taxpayer money and not really learn very much about the Saturn system, and that would be kind of a waste too. You know, of course, the other extreme couched in the context of Cassini is we would just not worry about it, the problem's too hard, and we would take no safety measures. And that wouldn't be a judicious use of resources either. So the approach that we did take, which is on page 17, called the Cassini approach, is in more detail. We gathered the best scientific minds about Saturn's ring systems that we could find, and most of them were already affiliated with the project, right, because this was going to be the next great mission to study Saturn and its rings, so they gravitated towards it naturally. We held a workshop at Ames Research Center, which is one of the NASA centers. It's in Northern California. We did this in 1995, and we said, oh, great, ring scientists, please tell us the project and us engineers what everything, you know, give us your best guess, and hopefully it's an educated guess or more than a guess of what these ring systems are like. What are the particle size distributions? You know, is there large stuff? Is there small stuff? What is the abundance of the particles? And so that we can take these and build them into models and then go off and do hazard assessments. And that workshop went very well. We also consulted with our spacecraft engineers and said, what parts of the spacecraft are vulnerable to dust impacts and what happens if things hit them at high speed? You know, how big does something have to be? How fast does it have to be traveling? What's the relationship between size and speed? What's the consequence of it hitting various parts of the spacecraft? And then from those two things, we can sort of model what kind of things might happen to the spacecraft as it flies around Saturn. And we can think about methods to mitigate the risk. And again, like the car example, you know, seat belts. airbags, avoiding bad weather. and the things that we can do are we can design the trajectory or redesign the trajectory as we learn things to avoid the most dangerous areas. That would be kind of like avoiding bad weather if you're driving. We can choose which spacecraft attitudes we use, because some parts of the spacecraft are more vulnerable than others, and maybe, you know, if we want to fly through a region and study it, we can choose an attitude that doesn't expose the most vulnerable parts of the spacecraft. So we mitigate the risk somewhat, but we don't, you know, we don't redesign the trajectory to avoid the region altogether, to so that we can study that part of the system. So we kind of, you know, split the difference. There are also we also made design changes to the spacecraft itself before we launched it, to try to protect the most vulnerable areas of the spacecraft. In this case, it's the main engine nozzles. Are very sensitive to particle impacts. They have this coating on them, and if the coating was removed by hitting, you know, something hitting it, you know, the as the engine fires, the heat of the plume of chemicals that are providing the thrust could, in the extreme case, cause a burn through of one of the engine nozzles and destroy the engine. Fortunately, we have two engines. We have a redundant pair, so if we lost one, it's possible we might be able to lose the other one, but it's still a chance we didn't want to take, so we added a cover for it. And let's talk about the stuff in a little bit more detail. So I'm on page 18 now. Hypervelocity impacts. We certainly had to explore the field, which was still a sort of new field of study, even in the 90s. There were still facilities being built that could test things at higher and higher speeds that we had never been able to reach before. And, you know, of course, we were worried about things like particles puncturing aluminum shielding and going past the aluminum shielding and damaging electronics. Some of the pictures you can see here sort of show sort of some of the impact test results of what can happen. There was, other than the main engine nozzles, which we designed a cover for that I'll show later, there was really no part of the spacecraft that was completely exposed to space. So in order for something to really hurt us, you know, a particle would have to sort of go through something and then hit sensitive components on the other side. And the sort of the picture in the lower left is an interesting case where this is an impact. You know, I think the size of the test particle is illuminated by the BB there. And you can see it didn't penetrate this block of presumably aluminum, but it created kind of a bubble on the other side, and that's, you know, sometimes things can hit us and not penetrate, but it knocks stuff off the other side that can then go forward and damage. So there's some really interesting parts, you know, of the high impact, high speed impact physics that are interesting to study. So, but mainly what we're worried about is the main engine nozzles where we have the cover, and also we do have some electronics that's only protected by one surface of aluminum. So that's why some of the pictures here are sort of relevant to sort of the tests that we used to sort of figure out what our damage might be. Anyway, the first problem we had to tackle, and that's on page 19, this chart's kind of complicated, was where we fly when we got to Saturn. This is kind of a cut through the Saturn ring system. The horizontal axis is sort of the horizontal dimension of the Saturn ring system. So the horizontal line here is Saturn's ring plane. The vertical axis is sort of distance above and below the ring plane. And Saturn would be way off to the left. You can see at the bottom there, distance from Saturn is the upper axis label. So that's 135,000 kilometers on the left and 200,000 kilometers from the center of Saturn. So Saturn would be way off to the left. Again, it's kind of a cut through it. The edge of the main rings is just barely peeking onto the left side of the chart there. This was the chart, one of the charts that we used to try to make decisions about where to fly. You've got the G ring, which we did know. This is actually I haven't changed the chart since before arrival. So this is, you can see down in 2001. This is the date of this chart, and this is sort of where we thought stuff might be as of 2001. And that's based a lot on the rings workshop we had from gathering input from the scientists in 1995. And you know, the X that's in the middle where it says Cassini RPX, that means Cassini Ring Plane Crossing at 158,500 kilometers. That was our aim point. That's where we wanted to fly through the ring plane. Now, we could have moved it way far to the right, but that would have cost a lot of propellant to do that, because we would have had to move it quite far to avoid these other regions you see there on the right, particularly that box that says Mimas Horseshoe. Because we thought the Saturn satellite Mimas might also harbor some dust in it. Dust can be stably survive in the orbits of satellites of Saturn. So you could kind of picture that if you took that sort of, you know, angled line and had to sort of just move it out without changing the angle to the right, you'd have to move it quite a distance before it cleared that line. And that would have cost us a lot of propellant, potentially so much propellant that we might actually not even still be flying, because we would have run out of fuel by now. So even though that would have been possibly safer because it would have been further away, this is kind of an example of this middle ground of decision-making, where you don't be so conservative that you really hamstring yourself and you prevent yourself from being able to fly the mission you want. At the same time, you don't want to take so much risk, that you're risk losing the spacecraft before you can study anything. It's a balance. You know, you're weighing many factors, and the main point that we chose, we thought it was at about as low in terms of how much stuff might be there as the region outside of well outside of Mimas. So that's the one we chose, and obviously we were successful. We also chose a specific spacecraft attitude that exposed the fewest sensitive components to dust for both. We actually crossed that region twice, an ascending crossing and a descending crossing. And we adopted that safe attitude both times just to make sure that we were doing everything we could to be safe. And as you could see, this region avoids the G-ring where Pioneer 11 and Voyager 2 flew successfully because the G-ring was more dangerous. And, you know, if we didn't have to fly through it, you know, why would we take that hazard? So we have since flown through some of the outer corner, like the little edges of the G-ring, again, because it's a ring we want to study, and the trajectory, you know, making trajectory changes can be expensive, and, you know, we've tried to adopt some of those protective measures as well. Page 20 also shows another region that we have worried about. One of the great Cassini discoveries was the fact that Saturn satellite Enceladus is expelling water vapor out of its south pole, and this is, again, kind of a horizontal cut with Enceladus sort of in the upper left of each plot. This was really exciting scientifically, and we wanted to study this, but we also worried that Enceladus might, in addition to harmless water vapor, might also be spewing out dust that could harm us. So one of the things we did is we kind of, there's a lot of sort of spaghetti on this page, a lot of different trajectories that you're showing. These are all paths of the spacecraft. One of the things we did was we kind of sort of stepped our way in gently. You know, if you see it on the chart on the left, you know, you could see E1, E2, those are in time order. So E1 is kind of pretty far away from sort of that plume that's sort of on the middle left. And E2, you know, gets a bit closer. That's sort of the curved plot, white curve. That's sort of in the middle. And E3 kind of starts, you know, we've starting to get into the plumes there. E3 was at the end of the Prime mission. Probably in 2008, I want to say, although it might have been in late 2007. With E4, we go in a little bit further, and so forth and so on. So as time goes on, once we've studied this region and have more understanding about it, we feel more comfortable taking more risk, because we've learned that it's not because it's later in the mission, you know, necessarily, but because we've learned more about the region, and we know that it's safe, and that's what happened. You know, as we studied the region, we came to the conclusion rather quickly that just the power required, the energy required to loft dangerous particles from the surface of Enceladus, really the satellite just didn't have the capability. You know, the mechanisms of how this water vapor comes out into space are such that it just doesn't have the energy or the power really to loft stuff that's big enough to hurt us in the space. So fortunately, this is a safe environment, and we can continue on with some of the the, you know, the flybys on the right, where we really go deeply into the plume, which is great news for the scientists. page 21 shows a little bit more about the protective measures that we took. The chart on the left is an image of Cassini before the thermal blanketing was put on it. It turns out thermal blanketing, even though it's a primary function, is to keep things warm when it's cold and cool when it's hot, is also a very good protector from micrometeoroids, because when dust strikes it, it tends to sort of vaporize into a shower of smaller particles, and sometimes those can be small enough compared to the apparent particle that they're no longer a hazard to us. So you can see again that most of the spacecraft is really not exposed. It's covered with this thermal blanketing. The high-gain antenna, the white thing on the top there, turns out that's the best insulator. Particles hitting that really have hardly any effect, because it doesn't affect our radio communications at all. You could pepper it with impacts, and it would still reflect our radio energy quite well. It's kind of like the screen in your microwave oven. You know, you can see inside, but none of the radiation gets out, because it's at a wavelength that won't penetrate that screen. And in a similar fashion, we could have holes in our antenna, and it would still be a perfectly good reflector. And that's what we use a lot to protect the rest of the spacecraft from stuff. On page 22 and 23, you see pictures of the main engine cover, which was added late in the design of the spacecraft to protect the engines. You can see without it, the engines sort of at the bottom of the chart on the right are totally naked to space, totally exposed. The only way we could protect them again is by sort of pointing the high-gain antenna sort of into the wind. But if we had to do that every time we got near any sort of dust, the scientists would really start to complain, because we'd be enforcing a spacecraft attitude that might not be convenient for collecting science often enough to annoy them. And if it's required for safety, it's required for safety. But fortunately, we have this cover that we can deploy and let the scientists sort of do their thing without being restricted by attitude-wise. Page 23 is some real-life pictures of, this is the engineering test model. This wasn't the one that actually flew, but it's identical in design. You can kind of see it. It looks kind of like a baby buggy on a stroller. It's got this. This is thermal blanketing, but it's also something we call beta cloth, which is a micrometeoroid protective layers. It's kind of like Kevlar. It's kind of like a bulletproof vest. If stuff, it's very hard for micrometeoroids to hit it and go through, much like a bullet going through a bulletproof vest. It would have to be a really, really fast or large particle, or a combination of both. So this gives you a flavor of the protective measures we've taken, both in design as well as in operations, to help us make middle way decisions to protect us from some hazard, but still allow us to not be so conservative that we don't get good science. And on page 24, the title is Proximal Orbits. Now I'd like to switch gears just a little bit and talk about how we're going to end our mission, because dust hazards are certainly an issue there, and it's something we continue to study. And certainly, I should mention, all along during the mission, we have learned more about the Saturn ring system, both the main rings and these faint rings that I've been talking about the most. And we've certainly had to adapt our models as we've gone, because we have, as we learn more about the rings, we realize that, some regions where we thought there might be dust don't contain dust after all, and vice versa, some regions that we didn't know there was dust do. So we have to we've had to adapt our planning as we've gone along. What we're planning to do at the end of the mission in 2017 is really exciting. We never thought this was possible, but it turns out that our trajectory designers figured out a clever way to get us from outside the main rings to just above the cloud tops of Saturn, and we can spend a number of orbits there getting really close to Saturn and studying a lot of phenomena that we never thought we'd get to study up close. And this is possible because we believe that there is a region between the cloud tops of Saturn and the main rings. You can kind of see it a little bit in the lower right image here, again on page 24. This is a chart that I made, and I tried to sort of enhance that sort of purple ring you see there. That's called the D ring. And that's, I've enhanced that sort of by hand compared to the main ring. So that, you know, that wouldn't really look like that in an unenhanced image, but I've tried to sort of show, you know, what we had seen previously in existing Cassini images. So where all those colored lines are flying is a region we believe either has no dust or has dust that is of low enough abundance that it should be safe for us to fly through there. And we're going to spend 22 orbits flying through this region. The scientists are really excited about it. We're just starting to plan these orbits now, even though they're, you know, they're 4 years down the road, to try to figure out, you know, how to maximize the science from this region. But we are, of course, you know, still worried about the dust here because, you know, we've never gone to this region, and you know, we only have a handful of images to sort of give us an idea of what's there. And the reason for that is because, you know, these rings are so faint. You know, some of the pictures I've shown you, you know, were taken at what's called very high phase, where the sun's behind the planet. You know, to image this region is really hard because it's between the planet and the main ring. So you have two bright objects that are right next to it. So to get an image where you can see this faint ring, it's tremendously difficult. You have to be in just the right geometry where Saturn is dark and the rings are dark, but that ring maybe is lit just a little bit, and you could probably imagine how difficult that is to sort of get just the right geometry. Fortunately, we've gotten close. Page 25 is called Saturn's D-ring. Here's some images we took just a few months ago of this region, and what you're seeing here is this two images. I've done the processing for these, and you can see there's some JPEG artifacts and other stuff. So I've just used the public images that are on the public website. If you want to look at these yourself, look at images that were taken on Saturn orbit 169. Anyway, at the lower left, you know, this is kind of, you're looking at the rings at an angle. At the lower left is the limb of Saturn. And this limb, even though it looks bright here, it's actually only lit by the ring. So you're looking at sort of the dark side of Saturn. And it's bright because I've sort of manually, you know, overexposed it and stretched it out. And the rings, the main ring system kind of starts sort of halfway up the image, or maybe two-thirds or three-quarters of the way up the image. And it's really overexposed because it's lit. The sort of line you see at the lower right of each image, that's the shadow boundary. So that's the shadow of Saturn being projected onto the rings. And this is really good because you can see, you know, you could see where it's easier for us to figure out sort of where the faint rings might end, because if we didn't have that shadow boundary and we saw bright, you know, bright stuff like we do see above it, you could say, oh, that's definitely dust, that's a ring, or you could say, well, it could be scattered light from the rings or from the planet, because again, you have two really bright objects near you, and it could be just scattered light in the camera. You don't really know which, but because we have that shadow boundary, we can say for sure that if we see stuff that's above the shadow boundary, which we do, sort of in the middle, you know, in the innermost part of those rings, which is the D-ring, we do see stuff that's some brightness above the shadow boundary and none below. So that's pretty positive evidence that there is dust there. The region we're planning to fly, fortunately, is kind of where you see nothing. Certainly it's a little bit easier on the image on the right, maybe. It's, you know, you see sort of some ringlets in the D-ring that are sort of faint, you know, the stuff that's not too overexposed. And then it kind of drifts to black. Depending on how you process the image, the scientists, you know, say, well, there might be stuff that goes all the way down to the cloud tops, but it's really faint, or there might not. So this is kind of a part of the dust hazard problem that we're really struggling with now. We're not struggling with it. We're grappling with it. We have this data. We processed it. We actually have a science meeting coming up in next month, in just a few weeks, and this is going to be one of the topics that's discussed, where we try to figure out, you know, what do these images really tell us? You know, what's the most plausible case for dust being there? How much protection should we assume? You know, where should we limit ourselves in terms of where to fly and where not to fly? So even though we've been at Saturn since 2004, you know, for 8.5 years now, this is still a very important topic today, and we still grapple with the same kinds of decisions. You know, worrying about being like Icarus, where if we fly too close to the D-ring here, you know, we might lose the spacecraft before we want to. But not wanting to be so conservative that, you know, we never, to use again, use the car analogy, we never leave our house and we never learn anything about the solar system. So, you know, these orbits are very scientifically exciting. They're going to occur right near the end of the mission. So it's not like we're saving, we have to save the spacecraft for something else after that. So it's probably okay to take a bit more risk than we might be comfortable with at this time to try to get, you know, this really good science. The last chart is just kind of a nice sort of little artistic rendering. This is minus the spacecraft, this is a nice image by Bjorn Johnson that kind of says, what might it look like if you were just above the cloud tops, sort of the Saturn looking at the rings? And I've put in the spacecraft there. And there's a nice quote there by a former NASA Associate Administrator for Space Science. It kind of captures kind of some of the things we've been talking about. You know, it's important to try to show some courage and go to places that might be risky that you haven't been to, because that's the point of exploration, after all, is to sort of learn new things. And if you take so many precautions and are so conservative that you don't want to take no risk, then you really won't learn anything, or you certainly won't learn as much as you might. So that's the end of my talk. I hope you found it stimulating, at least a little bit, and I hope you get some impressions of kind of the decision-making and kind of the problems that we have to grapple with issues like this, and all of the different things we have to balance and study sort of all at the same time to solve some of these problems. And I am now available for questions if anyone has any. So thank you for your attention.
So, Dave, thanks a lot. That was a really interesting talk. I know I appreciated it a lot. I'm going to take the moderator's privilege here. And one, I wanted to make a point. That Jupiter ring image, that wasn't actually the Discovery image. I think that was taken outbound. If you ever looked at the actual Discovery image, it's pretty amazing they figured out that was a ring, because it's like 7 times exposed and the camera was wobbling throughout it. But if you know it's a ring, it's there.
Cool.
So that
cool.
Out there. I was curious, you know, Pioneer 11 and Voyager 2 flew through the G-ring and they were successful, but was there any damage at all that was recorded? I mean, so they weren't destroyed going through the G-ring, but did they suffer any damage to any instruments that we know of?
There's evidence that there was any damage. You know, Voyager 2 had a problem with their scan platform at Saturn, and there was some thought that that it might have been hit by something, but I think the consensus is that, you know, they were using it very often at its maximum speed to try to get as many images as they could of different objects, and that they sort of maybe overused it, you know, used it beyond its capabilities a little bit. And I'm not trying to imply that they made a mistake, just that, you know, they thought they knew what the capabilities were, and its performance degraded a little bit faster maybe than they expected. Yeah, I mean, even if we flew through the G-ring, you know, the G-ring is still pretty faint. You know, you can't see it. You know, most of the pictures of Saturn that we're familiar with, not the ones I've shown, but the ones like from the ground, you know, from the ground-based pictures or the ones of Voyager where you could see the ring system. You know, the G-ring is still almost impossible to see in almost every geometry. You know, I've mainly shown the images where you can see it. So it's a really faint ring. There still really isn't very much stuff there. You know, it's like one part in a million. So even if we flew through it at the same location that they would, you know, odds are overwhelming that we would fly through it without being damaged. But they're not 100%. You know, it's like 99% or 99.5% or 98%. These are really high numbers. But again, going back to the risk management strategy, even though the probability is low of being damaged, the consequence of being damaged could be really high. We could lose the spacecraft. We could lose an instrument. You know, we could lose redundant components we might need later. So we try to avoid it when we can. You know, again, that's a good question, because it really, you know, it again drives home the point that, you know, you have to think of both the probability of something happen and the consequence of it happening.
Well, also, you know, factored into that is the frequency with which you encounter that risk, because as you mentioned, you pass through the ring plane twice every orbit, usually in a relatively empty place, but still. And I'm reminded that I came across an article today in the New York Times in the science section, which is just about this. It's about thinking about low-risk events and how you manage that risk that struck a chord listening to your talk. So if anyone else has any questions, please step forward and let Dave know.
Yes, it's Krishnadas from New Jersey. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes. On the same slide, that is slide 19, I'm just curious as to what the horseshoe is. Could you just explain that? The Mimas horseshoe at about 180 to 190 miles out.
Dave, do we have you on? I can't quite hear you if you are. Jeez, I hope we didn't lose the speaker. Is that you, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay, perhaps someone's got something kind of loud in the background. If they could mute their phone, perhaps we could hear Dave.
Hello, can you hear me, Sean?
Oh, I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, great. Sorry, I didn't do anything different to my what's the background. So anyway, let me know as soon as you hear any other audio problems with me. The horseshoe is kind of a familiar term for other reasons, but what this addresses is it's called the three body problem. So when you have a planet and a satellite, I alluded it to a little bit earlier, and the satellite is obviously orbiting the planet. It is possible for material to share the orbit of the satellite. There's a stable region that has a horseshoe shape. So it goes all the way around the planet, but it ends sort of not, you know, somewhat short of the satellite itself. So if you were looking down the orbit kind of from above, it would have kind of a horseshoe shape.
Is this related to the Lagrange points like L3 and L4, or is it something different?
Okay, yeah, I think that's a good question. I think you may have to mute so we can hear Dave.
Okay, can you hear me again now, Sean? Sean?
Yep. Yeah, you're back.
Okay, great. The Lagrangian points we would call tadpoles. We call them Lagrangian points too, but the horseshoe region would include Lagrangian points. I believe 3, 4, and 5. I think 1 and 2 are on either side of the satellite, and then 5 is on the opposite side of the planet from the satellite, and then 3 and 4. maybe it's 4 and 5. Maybe 3 is on the opposite side, and 4 and 5 are trailing. 4 and 5, kind of 60 degrees on either side of the satellite, and there. Go on. Can you still hear me?
Still hear you.
There are other orbits called tadpoles that orbit those Lagrangian points, L4 and L5, that are other subsections of the whole horseshoe. But we call it the Mimas horseshoe or the Enceladus horseshoe or the Dione horseshoe for other satellites because that's all the way around the orbit, so it doesn't matter where the satellite is unless the satellite's right on top of you. You know, there could be dust there. And that's why we colored it in that box, and we wanted to make sure that we were aware of the dimensions of it. Because we thought there could have been dust sharing the orbit of that satellite, and we didn't want to fly through that region if we didn't have to.
So does this mean that region that is dusty, it can be above and below the ring plane or the orbital plane of the satellite, or is it on the same plane? I'm not sure if I understand that correctly.
Sure, that's a good question. Sean, I'm still on, right? Sean, can you hear me?
You are. Yeah.
I keep asking just to make sure. Yeah, it's definitely one of the sort of intermediate to advanced things about these rings that we learned. It's not all confined to the ring plane. Now, the reason why this is a box and not just a dot or like a band like the G-ring is because MIMAS, the satellite MIMAS, its orbit is slightly eccentric, meaning it goes sort of in on this chart. Again, we're on page 19. The moon will go sort of go inward and outward depending on where it is in its orbit, and it also has an inclination, which means it'll go up vertically on this chart, up and down. And any dust that shares the orbit of the satellite can accrue electricity and inclination as that of the satellite. So that's why it's a box, because stuff can be floating anywhere within that box, and it's sort of like it's a horseshoe donut, right? It's a shape that has length, width, height, all three dimensions, right? As it gets projected around Saturn, and that's true for any satellite, any moon of Saturn that has dust in its orbit that has an eccentricity and or an inclination. Stuff can be kicked up out of the ring plane and can be kicked out radially, to occupy that box. So yeah, good questions. What else?
Do we have any other questions out there?
Yeah, this is David Fair. Came in a little late on us, David. Saturn's rings on slides 9 and 14. What's the difference between the two images?
Okay, 9 and 14. Let's see. Okay, 9 is the most recent one, and 14, yeah. So 14 was taken in 2006. I believe 9 was taken just last year. I think it might have been taken late in the year because it's a really recently released mosaic. The color schemes are quite a bit different. I think the best bet is to is to try to find the captions for those images. I think I might have one of them in front of me. But I know the sort of greener one was taken using ultraviolet, I think violet and red filters. Explanation is that it was taken with a different set of filters so that the color balance looks different. I'm trying to pull up the caption for it now. Here it is. The subtitle of it is "A Splendor Seldom Seen." That's the name of the image. And this one was taken. I reversed it. Infrared, red, and violet spectral filters. The way they enhance the color, really, the results really depend on the specifics of which filters were chosen. You shouldn't infer that the character of the ring has somehow changed from 2006 to last year. It's just that the filters, you're getting a different response because there's sort of all different particle sizes in these rings and how they reflect the different wavelengths of light. It really depends on the particle size, so that's why they look different.
Right, and the rings up on top are the rings that go in front of the planet, and then in the rings behind it, so those are visible infrared level. The shadow of the rings up on top.
I think the rings at the bottom are those are the ones that are behind the planet.
Right.
You're not seeing those. The ones up top, I think, what you're seeing here, this is another really interesting feature of Saturn. There's almost no point on the dark side of Saturn that is completely dark. So what you're seeing there is like the green bands on either side of the upper half of the planet. That's reflected light from the rings, from the lit sides of the rings. So the sun is hitting the rings, illuminating them, and that reflected light is shining on Saturn. So those dark bands you see at the top are the rings themselves that are unlit, blocking the view of the dark, quote, dark, unquote, side of Saturn, which is actually not completely dark. It's being lit by reflected light from the rings. So the rings are completely black because they're totally unilluminated are blocking the light from there. So it's a curious problem, definitely.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, this is John Conrad, Pennsylvania Solar System Ambassador. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, John.
Okay. Back to slide 19, which somebody else drew our attention to there. Now I'm curious. I look at the E-ring box out there. Is the E-ring, in fact, does it really have that vertical extent beyond the ring plane that's not the same and much larger than the F and the G, and if so, why? And
yeah, the E-ring is definitely the most vertically extended ring, at least of the part of the Saturn system that we're talking about that we're flying through. It turns out that, you know, the E-ring, we believe, is almost entirely fed by these plumes of Enceladus. Now, again, I'm an engineer and I'm talking science, but I'm explaining to me what I understand, so you may get a better answer from one of the real ring experts. But it turns out that the E-ring, again, because there isn't enough energy at Enceladus, you know, at its south pole to loft big stuff, is almost entirely water vapor, which, you know, molecular, plus water, tiny water ice droplets that are no bigger than about a micron or you know, a millionth of a meter in radius or diameter. I mean, say roughly, you know, we're talking roughly the same sizes. It turns out that for that specific size, there are some other dynamics of where they are in the Saturn system. You know, particles that are really small can acquire a charge and then be affected by the magnetic fields of Saturn. They also can be pushed around a little bit by solar pressure. You know, when you get to stuff that's that small, you know, that those really small forces start to be relevant. So it turns out that they can be kicked up out of the ring plane, and they can actually live there. Now, they don't hover above the ring plane constantly. They still have, for any one orbit, they still have an orbit that looks like a Keplerian ellipse or something, right, where it'll cross up out of the ring plane and part of its orbit and then cross down below the ring plane at the other part of its orbit. So, but there's, you know, they're all randomly distributed or almost randomly distributed. So you get this sort of cloud of stuff that has a thickness that can be tens of thousands of kilometers thick, as it's shown here. And that's unusual because, you know, Saturn is so oblate bodies tend to, the gravity of an oblate body tends to want to squash everything down to the ring plane. And it's because of the particle sizes of this ring in particular make it so that these particles can survive, you know, can last for very long times out of the ring plane. Now, with Mimas, again, it's because that satellite itself has an inclination and an eccentricity. So it can, stuff could, if it was there, could interact with the satellite and get kicked up and down. But out sort of in away from satellites, like the E-ring is mostly, you know, it's really just Saturn's gravity that is the dominant factor, right? And it just, again, it so happens that for one micron-sized particles, you know, you can, or smaller, you know, their dynamics can allow them to survive out of the ring plane.
Let me just say that it sounds like that ring is much thicker, but do I understand much less dense than the F and G?
Well, I will say, yeah, it's definitely much thicker in terms of just
right.
It would also be much less dense. If you squash the entire E-ring down to, if you squashed all these rings down to being, like, you know, infinitely thin, I think other than perhaps right at the orbit of Enceladus where, you know, which is the peak brightness of the E-ring, right, that's where the source is, I think the E-ring would probably be about or maybe less, a little bit less dense than the G-ring. The F-ring is certainly more dense than everything. Its core is really bright. It's visible from the ground way before you can see the G-ring or the E-ring in telescopes. But certainly what's important for us is the E-ring is poses almost no hazard. It's all composed of these tiny particles. And you know, even if we get hit by, you know, 100 of them or 1,000 of them, if we fly through it, you know, there's no way they can cause any damage. You know, they'd strike the spacecraft and bounce off or stick either way. And it wouldn't, you know, we'd notice the impacts on some of our more sensitive instruments, but they really pose no hazard to us.
Thank you.
So, yeah, Dave, you pretty much got the dynamics right about why the G-ring has a physical thickness. I wouldn't, as a rings person, I wouldn't complain about anything you said there. But I did have a question. You know, you mentioned New Horizons, and I know that you've been kind of at least peripherally involved in looking at their dusk risk. Do you know how they're attempting to quantify it? What kind of observations are they using? What are they doing to figure out what's in the Pluto system?
Sure, sure. Yeah, this issue may be New Horizons' biggest problem right now, certainly, you know, between now and when they get there. And, yeah, I've been dialing into a lot of telecons and talking to a lot of New Horizons people and trying to sort of pass on sort of some tips and tricks, I hope, of what we did on Cassini to help them. I think, you know, they really had the same, you know, they had really come to the same conclusions as I did in terms of the approach to take to sort of quantify the hazards and to sort of figure out what they could do. So they were really well on a good track, you know, without my help. I think I've been of some assistance to them, but, you know, they have a lot of smart people on that project, too. They have an even tougher time than Cassini did because they're almost in, like, the Pioneer-Voyager situation because nothing's ever been to Pluto before. We at least had Pioneer 11, Voyager 1 and 2 that had been there. And you know their target of interest is you know four or more times further away than Saturn is, so it's even harder to with ground base up to figure out what's going on at Pluto than it is at Saturn. What they've done is you know they collected what ground based stuff they had. I think they got a number of orbits on Hubble just last year. I believe June and July they were allocated a really large block of time, many orbits in a row, I think, of Hubble for observations of Pluto, which is unusual to have that much time, you know, on a world-class telescope like that, to try to, you know, drive down the upper limits of what might be there. You know, they've never positively detected anything, but because Pluto, you know, now is known to have, you know, five Pluto and Charon plus four other moons because it has a bunch of moons there, you know, and it's a low gravity system. It's certainly plausible that Pluto could have rings as well. They can't rule it out, so that you know they have to. It's the same kind of thorny problem. They can't rule it out, so they have to try to address it. And there's so little data that you know the upper limits of what could be there, but it's not quite detected yet, are still high enough to sort of cause them concern. You know, if stuff was hiding just barely beneath the limit of detectability, you know, it could be a problem for them. So there's a lot of work going on right now, strangely in parallel with, you know, our work of trying to assess the hazard of the D-ring. We're kind of on the same track for certainly different objects and different reasons. And, you know, what they're going through the same thing we did. You know, they're looking at their spacecraft design and trying to estimate what parts of their spacecraft are the most vulnerable. They're trying to nail down, you know, where what regions to worry about. You know, they're thinking of using their antenna to shield vulnerable parts of the spacecraft from damage for part of their flyby, like we do. You know, we have the luxury of having had in planning and in the past, many orbits of Saturn. So if we have to use our antenna for a piece of one orbit, you know, it doesn't hurt us that much. They only have one flyby, so using their antenna at all, you know, could be a significant impact to their science. So they really have a tough problem ahead of them, and they're sort of starting their review cycle of presenting their conclusions and work to their own management as well as, you know, NASA and other center management that's knowledgeable in this field to try to come to a consensus on what to do.
Okay, so if we have no other questions out there.
One last question here.
Okay.
You know, we talked about the risk of impact with micro dust and stuff around Saturn, but I'm just wondering, what are the risks, or are there any perceptible risks for the spacecraft when it tries to get away from Earth?
you know, in terms of space debris, and also while crossing the asteroid belt. How about those risks? Are they perceptible or something that you guys need to worry about?
Yeah, question. Sean, am I still on, by the way?
You are.
Okay, good. It turns out it's a little funny, but the main engine cover actually was never put on the spacecraft to protect from dust at Saturn. It's not a detail I intentionally left out, but I'm glad you reminded me of it. That cover was actually designed to protect us from micrometeoroids during the interplanetary trajectory, during our cruise to Saturn. Certainly space debris in the interplanetary environment was a concern. You know, we certainly kept the cover closed when we weren't using the engines, which was, you know, most of the time. We had, obviously launch and one Earth flyby. I doubt we used it much at launch, because I think the cover probably had to be open. Well, I think just the launch environment, you know, we whatever configuration we were in was what we had to live with, and we didn't really have, complete control of the spacecraft and its equipment until we were rather well away from Earth, and any Earth orbiting space debris was no longer a problem. I believe the Earth flyby was at 500 kilometers. That's certainly low enough to be a concern for space debris, so I'm sure that the debris tracking centers like NORAD and others, I'm sure there was a whole, I wasn't on the project at that particular time, but I'm sure there was they looked at it, and I would be surprised if the cover wasn't closed for that flyby, just to make sure. The default position during cruise was the cover closed, and there was no maneuver during your flyby. So I would be shocked if it wasn't closed. Certainly during the interplanetary environment, you know, I think it was kept closed to protect us from stuff. The asteroid belt, I don't think we worried about, you know, the asteroid belt, there are many, you know, there are many tens of thousands of asteroids, but the asteroid belt is spread over such a wide area of space that, the probability is so low of hitting anything. I actually helped conduct the asteroid study to try to find out if we were going to fly close to any asteroids, and even with many, many tens of thousands of asteroids, you know, we only got to within some tens of thousands of kilometers of like one or two, it was probably quite a bit further this and that. I think Masursky and were two asteroids that we got closest to, and it was probably millions of kilometers rather than tens of thousands. I don't think the asteroid belt has a significantly higher small dust population than the rest of the interplanetary environment. I don't believe that any spacecraft that have flown through the asteroid belt have ever really detected a significantly higher flux of dust than at anywhere else. I don't think that was a specific concern. Of course, this was all looked at, right? We have to study it, right? We don't just bury our heads in the sand, but none of those were as significant as, say, flying through the edges of the G-ring.
So now I understand why it is that we exceeded the engine cover cycle limit a while back. And it's never intended to be used this long, I get it.
Yeah. We've opened and closed more times than we predicted, because we never thought we'd use it as many times at Saturn as we did, but it's...
Okay. All right, well, I would like to thank our speaker once again. It's really interesting, very informative talk. I would like to remind everyone that the next CHARM Telecon is anticipated to be held in April 2013. We haven't yet identified a speaker, but when we do, we'll make sure to include that information in the next communication that you receive from us. And I also would like to invite anyone who had any trouble downloading the PDFs or anything like that to communicate your issues to us so that we can try to help anticipate and resolve that in the future. So thanks again, Dave. And with that, I'd like to wish everyone a good day or evening, wherever you may be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.